Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 41 for Monday, April 12, 2010, taking it to the edge. This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Welcome, everybody, to yet another hour. Episode 41, we're taking it to the edge. We're taking it to the edge of physics, actually, with Anil Ananthaswamy. He has written a book called The Edge of Physics. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to work at the top of a mountain in the clouds, or at the bottom of a deep mine shaft, or in Antarctica, where it's freezing, and do science? Have you ever thought what it would be like to do that? Well, Anil thought that and then said, I'm going to find out what it's like and I'm going to write a book about it. So he's been all over the world to the most extreme places on the planet in search of physics and understanding what scientists are doing out in these crazy places and what they're learning about our universe. So Anil, thank you so much for joining me today. Thanks for driving here to Petaluma and coming out to the cottage. It's great to have you here in person.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. The drive was really nice.
Good. It's not too shabby.
It's a beautiful drive.
Yeah. What was the first thing that you thought of that that really triggered you to go to these places, to come up with this idea for this book, to get out and start traveling the world for science?
For a while, I had been actually thinking of writing a novel, and had started working on a novel which had physics at its heart. Mm. And I got stuck, pretty much, because I couldn't figure out the structure of the novel the way it should be written. And around the same time, I became physics news editor for New Scientist, and I came to Berkeley, to Stanford, to talk to physicists, to just get an understanding of what's happening in physics so that I could do my job better.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during one of these conversations with a cosmologist, at the very end of sort of our discussion, I told him about this, this idea of that I was thinking about of writing a novel, but also that I just wanted to travel to mountaintops and write about telescopes.
Right.
And it was a kind of a harebrained idea which didn't have much meat on it. And he put this little seed of an idea in my head, saying that, well, you don't have to stop at mountaintops. You can go to, like you said, to deep underground mines or to Antarctica or to Siberia, because there are physics experiments that are happening all over the place. And they're literally and metaphorically at the ends of the earth. And that was the beginning of the idea that, oh, I could tell the story of what's happening in cosmology, but as a travelogue, so that I could go to these places and report back firsthand about the kind of physics that's happening really at the very ends of the earth.
What was the first place that you went?
The first place was Chile, very, very high in the Atacama Desert in the Chilean Andes. And I must say it was a very surreal experience, because Chile is that part of Chile is very, very dry. The Atacama Desert is pretty much the driest part of the planet. It hasn't rained there for decades, some of the parts of the desert. And I flew into Santiago from all the way from London, which was a long, long flight. And then from there, another flight to Antofagasta, which is on the coast up towards the middle part of this long sliver of a country. And from there, another 2 hours of driving into the desert, and you travel through landscape that's just brown, endless brown, not a blade of grass, no sign of life, and you get up into these mountains, and suddenly someone else had described looking at the picture that's on the cover of my book and saying that it looks like, and that particular telescope that I went to see in Chile is on the cover, it looks like some little city, magical city, in the middle of this completely brown litany of hills.
It just pops out of nowhere.
It does just emerge. It's not a city, it's just four telescopes, and astronomers live there. But yeah, it's an extraordinary place.
What went into what you were, as you were planning your trip, what went into your planning, into your preparation, into putting together everything that you needed for not just journeying and adventuring, but also being able to record the stories that you wanted to then tell people?
Well, the first thing I had to do was figure out which of these experiments I had to visit, because I sort of had to pick experiments that, if when they were put together, I could then tell the story of physics.
Yeah.
So the first thing I had to do was find out, okay, which of these experiments are the most important ones, and can they all tell me bits and pieces of the bigger puzzle?
Mm-hmm.
And that was step one. But then I was also looking for really extreme places in a very deliberate fashion, because I felt like part of what I wanted to convey was to the magic of physics, but by using a proxy, the landscape, the people who are doing these works.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of thought that went into selecting the sites just based on some of the wonderful locations that they were being done in. So Siberia and Chile and, of course, Antarctica and things like that. So it wasn't hard to do. I mean, they're being done in some pretty amazing places.
There are. I mean, you look at some, I mean, and it's physics mostly. I mean, there are people, yes, biology and anthropology, cultural yes. studies, paleontology. You know, people are going, scientists are going all over the world, but and exploring and adventuring. And there's definitely that adventure story
yep.
that lies at the heart of so much of science. But physics is so incredible in terms of the way it just make creating these giant telescopes, or, you know, putting a structure at the bottom of a mine shaft. I mean, yeah.
It's unbelievable.
They come up with these ideas. Yeah.
You wouldn't think that physics would be done at these places, but it turns out that most of our listeners would know of the Large Hadron Collider, which made mm-hmm. big news just a couple of days ago.
Yeah,
and that's a gigantic machine, and yes,
like yay, seven trillion or electron
yeah,
volts,
yeah, seven tera electron volts,
yeah. exactly. Yes. They've actually got some data coming out of it. It's so
yeah,
exciting.
It is amazing, and that experiment is sort of an example of how extreme physics has become in terms of the experiments, and that's because a lot of the questions we are trying to answer in physics have become very difficult and need experiments that just get bigger and more sophisticated.
Yeah.
And not just that, they can't really be done in your average lab in a university anymore. You need very, very quiet environments where there's no light pollution, no radio wave pollution. You need gigantic bodies of clear water or huge amounts of ice the ability to launch balloons that stay up aloft for long periods. And all of these happen to be very extreme locations. And the physicists have had no problems with that. They trek all over the globe to do these things. Yeah.
Do you think that the physicists who do this, are they self-selecting? I mean, are they after the physics? Or do you think there's a heart of an adventurer in the people who actually end up in these places?
I'm sure there's a bit of both. Some of the physicists I met are, they're definitely driven by their desire to understand, the underpinnings of nature. So that's there.
Yeah.
But the breed of physicists I met are experimentalists. So these are not people sitting with a paper and pencil in their office and coming up with theories. Their mindset is something very different. They are willing to work for 30 years on one experiment, knowing fully well that at the end of it, what they're looking for might not exist. And
which is amazing.
Yes,
it's amazing.
It is, and so they are, I think, in a certain way, adventurous, and mm-hmm. In a way that most of us find it really hard to understand. Why would you spend so much time? But they typify a very dogged breed of people.
Right, a breed of people who's willing to take an idea and stick with it, who are willing to, like the early adventurers who were looking for the edge of the earth,
yeah.
you know, the first people to sail around the earth. They're looking for something much bigger than they were, and they were willing to spend the time
yeah.
to do that.
Yeah. And that was brought home to me in Antarctica, because Antarctica, is a very new continent for us. It's only about 100 years ago that Robert Scott and Shackleton and others just, you know, made it to the South Pole. Well, Shackleton didn't, but Robert Scott did, and so did Amundsen. And when you go to Antarctica, to the U.S. base at McMurdo, the history of these explorers is all around you. The huts that they built, their last meal that's still lying, you know, in the pots and pans that they were using, the seal or the dog they had killed for some reason, the meat is just lying there because it's so cold, nothing is thawed yet.
And there's no deterioration.
Yes. And you read stories about these people just 100 years ago and the kind of things they did to get to the South Pole, for instance. But juxtaposed with that is the modern effort, which is of science in Antarctica. And these people are just doing just as amazing work of a different kind and asking very different questions. But it is, they do typify that breed.
What was, okay, two questions. I guess I'll get to them one at a time. Sometimes I get ahead of myself. I want to ask the questions all at once. Do you think that you found an adventurer in yourself? Are you hungering for more adventure in the world since starting this voyage and like going to all these different places? Are you glad you've done it, but you're done? Like, where do you sit now?
Oh, I'm very glad I've done it. In fact, I look back at the travels. You know, it's been a couple of years since the last travel, and I look back at them and think that it was all a dream because all these trips happened within about 3 years. I literally went to all continents, at least stepped foot on all continents. And do I feel like I want to go back? I would love to go back to many of these places. In fact, almost every place was very special, Chile, Siberia. And I would feel emotional sort of leaving each place. But at the back of my mind, there was always this knowledge that if I had the time and money, I could come back.
Right.
Except for the South Pole. When I was leaving the South Pole, I think I had tears in my eyes because I knew that this was it. This I couldn't possibly never get back there again.
Wow.
Because it's so difficult to get there. And you have to have all the stars aligned for you to make it there. And mine did for a brief period. And
I just got goosebumps.
At the South Pole, I think I was, you know, in tears. Well, not totally, but yes.
Was the South Pole your favorite experience, or what would you say your, you know, in terms of the trips you took, what was the most impactful to you?
The most impactful would have been Antarctica, and I hesitate to say South Pole, just the South Pole, only because Antarctica itself, you land at McMurdo, which is on the coast, and it's the coast that's the most dramatic. That's where you get a sense of just how surreal the continent is. There's nothing that we encounter in daily life, especially someone like me who's grown up in a warm country like India, to see the ice. I mean, maybe someone from Minnesota wouldn't bat an eyelash.
Right?
Yes. But but for me, just, you know, looking at this vast expanse of ice and volcanoes, active volcanoes that are about 12,000, 13,000 feet high, rising just straight off, you know, from the coast. And so cold that at the top you can see steam coming out, and yet there are glaciers on the top at 12,000 feet. So Antarctica was very profound. And then South Pole, oddly, is featureless. It's just ice. It's flat.
You find it based on GPS or...
Yes, well, now they can monitor the sun and figure out that you're at the South Pole. But that's what people like Robert Scott and Amundsen would have done. Now, of course, they have GPS and they can tell.
Wait, we can do something without technology? What?
Yes, exactly. What? Yes. But this, I think the South Pole was... I was, for about 10 days that I was at the pole, I was struggling to get a sense of the immensity of that place because it is very, very flat, but it's at a high altitude. It's about 9,000 feet of ice. You're standing on 9,000 feet of ice, and any direction you look, it's just ice, ice, and more ice. And the last day, I decided to just take a walk along the runway. So the runway is just a strip of compacted ice. Right, exactly.
It's
more ice. But it's relatively firm because, you know, they compact it so that the planes can land on skis. And I walked away for about a couple of miles, and got away from the South Pole station, which is actually, you know, the sense of people and population is very strong at the South Pole station. Mm-hmm. There's all this construction going on. So the moment I walked away, I realized that the thing about the South Pole was that it actually made you really aware of your own self, because it doesn't seem to offer you anything in terms of relief. There are no mountains, no seas. It just sort of stares at you in the face, and you stare back, and eventually you realize that it's making you confront yourself. And that was a very profound moment. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah.
But it was, I could imagine then what must have happened to these explorers who spend days and weeks and months on the ice, and all they had finally was to look within themselves. It would have forced them to do so.
That's got to be just an amazing moment that so many people never have the opportunity to face up to themselves that way. We're constantly surrounded by the cities, the towns, if we go out into nature, there's usually, there are hills, there are fields, there are mountains, there's stuff.
Yeah.
And there's sound also. Yeah. So to go someplace where there's ice and silence, and
that's what it was, ice and silence. and that was the beginning of this understanding that silence is actually really important for physics, which took me a while to figure out. But
how is that?
Well, because not silence in terms of sound, mm-hmm. but they need silence in terms of light. Like, so there shouldn't be any light pollution for telescopes. That's a kind of silence.
Right.
Radio telescope.
Get rid of the electromagnetic interference.
Yes. So it's a different kind of silence that they need. And they also need silence for certain experiments. They have to go deep into mines because mm-hmm. the surface of the Earth is really noisy for such experiments. There are lots of cosmic rays and radioactivity. Even our bodies are radioactive enough for it to be noisy for them. Mm-hmm. So they have to go deep into the Earth for that kind of silence. And without that silence, their instruments would not work. And so that was, I think, for me, another sort of revelation, standing at these places, especially the last trip, which was in the Indian Himalayas. I was standing on a peak where the telescope was, and right across, just literally about a kilometer, about a mile mm-hmm. or two in front, was another hill with a 400-year-old Buddhist monastery. And that to me was, the juxtaposition was just so beautiful. On one hill you have telescopes,
right,
which need a kind of silence, and on the other hill are the monks who also need a kind of silence for what they are doing. And it was very, that was another profound moment.
And I've got a picture here, actually, I'm going to bring up. So you have on your website a photo journey, and you have this is the Mount Wilson Observatory in Southern California, outside of Pasadena.
Pasadena,
Pasadena,
yes,
right? Yeah. And I've been there.
It's, you have. Yes.
I've been there. Yeah, it's a lovely place, but it's not so distant as some of these other places
No, and you know, Mount Wilson would have been extreme at some point 100 years ago. That particular chapter is a chapter about the history of cosmology. That's where Edwin Hubble did all his work and figured out that our universe is much more than the Milky Way, mm-hmm. that there are galaxies outside the Milky Way, and that they're all rushing away from us. That was our first intimations of a Big Bang.
And here's another. Moving on from the Big Bang, we had the formation of galaxies, like the Andromeda Galaxy. In this chapter, you went into the abandoned mine shaft.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Which I've read about, and I've just been... How many feet below ground is the mine shaft?
Half a mile underground.
Half a mile. And here's a picture of the elevator. Is some of this stuff relatively old, or
it's all very old. So the mine...
It's a dangerous little elevator.
I'm sure they keep it safe, but it is a very scary ride. It takes about 3 minutes to go all the way down. And this mine was the mine started in the 1880s, and it continued being mined until the 1960s, and then they shut it because I think it was economically not viable.
Right.
But then about 20 years ago, the physicists decided that they could
we can use this.
Yeah, we can use it. And thankfully, the miners have left behind a wonderful lift or elevator that mm-hmm. goes all the way down to the 27th level and the hoist that can get this cage out.
Right.
And the physicists just, that's the only mode of transport. That cage that you saw is the only way you can get
in and out. There are no stairs.
No. So this particular picture is a drift tunnel when you get down to the 27th level. And if you look to your left, when you get out of the cage, you see a drift tunnel. This is the tunnel that the miners would have used to bring ore to the cage and take it up. And then, we went in further in
into the darkness.
Into the darkness. We were actually standing inside one of the caverns that had been excavated by the miners many, many decades ago. And it's these gigantic holes in the rock that are left behind. And the guide, our guide was showing us how little light the miners worked with. This was the kind of, they worked literally in candlelight. And then you turn, that's a lunchroom that the miners left behind with all their stuff still there.
Still there. They just left it.
Yeah.
Probably some of the stuff, we don't need that. We're not coming back again.
And the astonishing thing is that when you turn right from the cage, as soon as you get out of the cage, this is what you're confronted with. This is the modern lab.
Wow. And, yeah, it goes from looking very
completely dark
and basic and dark and, and suddenly it's very modern.
It's very, very modern. There's thousands of tons of equipment there. And that's a wonderful mural that celebrates particle physics that's been painted inside inside the lab. And in my mind, this is a modern-day cave painting. So if some explorer
someday
wandered into this mine when it was all defunct again and they explored the cave and found this painting, it would be our version of a cave painting.
That's fascinating. Yeah, it would be preserved down there.
I would imagine it would be preserved. And so these are just some pictures of the experiments that are looking for dark matter. So as pictures, they're not terribly interesting, but the experiment is quite incredible. This is the hoist that's used to bring the cage up.
Some serious gears there.
Yes.
That's good. I like seeing that. Yeah. And we also had a video that you wanted, that you thought would be good to show, that I think would be fun to show. And so what is it that we are about to see?
So this is an experiment that I went to see in Antarctica. So at near McMurdo Station in Antarctica, they have experiments. This is a balloon launch. This is a long-duration balloon launch that used to get experiments up into the stratosphere. So you can see this giant helium-filled balloon, which is about to lift off. And the helium, because it's so cold, is very, very compressed in volume. And by the time it reaches about an altitude of 30, 40 kilometers, it's going to expand to about 40 million cubic feet. And the balloon is going to be 400 feet across.
400 feet, because it'll just expand and expand.
The helium will expand. And
as the pressure decreases,
the temperature
higher.
Changes, exactly.
And so that looked like a pretty complicated box that they were...
Experiment was going to study cosmic rays. So they have to get above Earth's atmosphere in order to study cosmic rays properly. And this particular experiment would have gone around the South Pole for about 2 weeks. And then it would have been brought down. So retrieval of the experiment itself is connected to the balloon by a parachute. And then there's an explosive that they can detonate.
At any time.
At any time. And once they detonate the explosive, the experiment free falls and then a parachute opens up. And the idea is that they can bring it down on land somewhere near where they are. It usually falls in some very, very harsh parts of Antarctica and in massive crevasse fields.
And then they have to go find it.
And they can locate it because it probably has, transponders and GPS and all that stuff. So they know where it has fallen. But actually getting to it is not easy at all. There's one particular experiment when it landed in a giant field of crevasses and they had to take two very, very expert skiers and rope them up so that if one of them fell into a crevasse, the other could pull the first skier out. And these two had to ski together for about 30 miles and then get the experiment out, the data, and then ski back.
Yeah.
And that was one of the easier recoveries.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The things that must be done for science.
It is crazy, and especially this experiment. There's one more incident where the parachute is supposed to separate from the payload just as soon as the thing lands on the ice.
Yeah.
And in one instant, it didn't separate, and the winds were blowing at about 10 knots. So this huge parachute was essentially open, blowing around on the surface and dragging this experiment with it. And the scientists had to fly in a small plane, land near the experiment where it was just fluttering around. And they would land and run towards the experiment to cut the parachute. But then the winds would change direction. The whole thing would come at them. And they would have to run back, get onto their plane, and fly over it again and come back in from another direction. And eventually they managed to snag it. But, you know, these are dangerous things they do.
It is. It sounds very dangerous. I mean, Antarctica sounds like it would be one of the more dangerous places, where it's the conditions aren't really, they're the unpredictable, where the weather can change, where, you know, you're just not dealing with California.
Yes, that kind of weather.
Now, you went also to Lake Baikal. Lake Baikal is the deepest lake in the world. And I personally, I have a fascination with all things Russian. And so Siberia, I had a professor I worked for who did his postgraduate training, his postdoctoral research in Siberia. Mm. And so he had lots of great stories of the Siberian tundra. What were you doing? What were they doing in the lake? What are they using this deep lake for?
So this particular experiment, the Russians are looking for something called neutrinos. Neutrinos are subatomic particles that pretty much will go right through matter. They don't interact with matter much at all. So if you were to hold out your hand, about a trillion neutrinos will pass through your hand, which are coming from the sun. Yeah, there you go.
I'm catching neutrinos.
So the idea is that the only way to really catch them or see them is if they were to hit the nucleus of an atom directly, and if they were to hit a nucleus of water, then there's a blue light that's produced, and if they can watch for this blue light and study the properties of this blue light, then they can understand where these neutrinos are coming from, what their energy is, and things like that. We've detected neutrinos from the sun and, you know, from the atmosphere and things like that. But they're really interested in neutrinos from outer space.
Right. They're really high energy neutrinos.
But there are very, very few high energy neutrinos. So their numbers start falling as their energy goes up. So the only way to have any chance of finding one of these is to monitor really large volumes of some material like water or ice. And the best place is something like Lake Baikal. So what they're doing is they essentially have detectors that are submerged a mile under the surface to look for this blue light that would come out when a neutrino hits a water molecule. That's what they're doing. And they've built this telescope, which they call the Lake Baikal Neutrino Telescope.
Which is just deep under the surface.
So essentially, imagine you're looking for this blue light. So you're looking at it. Using detectors, which are like artificial eyes,
What they call photo multipliers,
Photo multiplier tubes. The sort of the opposite of a television tube. So in a television tube, you would supply electricity, you get out light, and these photo multiplier tubes, the opposite is happening. They see light and give you an electrical signal, and they have 228 of these artificial eyes that are submerged deep inside Lake Baikal. Yeah,
Imagining that during the winter, especially, is it just still? Is there a lot of upwelling? Does it have water movement? Is that why it makes such a good place for a telescope?
So the winter has to do more with the financial situation of the Russian scientists. So because in order to actually build this telescope and maintain it and all that, if they were to be doing it in summer when the lake is not frozen, or in autumn, then they would need ships to sort of, you know, float on the water, and they would need submersibles to go down and wire up the instruments and things like that. And they haven't had the money ever since the Soviet Union fell. They've had a really big shortage of funds. And they've come up with this really ingenious idea of how to do this on the cheap.
I think so, physicists and computer IT specialists are probably the computer engineers, probably the best at doing things on the cheap.
Yes, yes. And the Russians especially so,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And what they do is they wait for Lake Baikal to completely freeze over. And then they essentially establish an ice camp on top of the lake, exactly where their experiment is. They cut holes in the ice and they will send a diver into this freezing water and try to get the experiment, the telescope out of the water, do all their maintenance, repairs and everything. And then they have to put it back, wire it up again, mm-hmm, and get out before the ice melts, because they are standing on a mile deep lake. You don't want to fall in. So when I called them up and said, I want to come and see your experiment, they said, of course you can come, but you have to come in winter because that's the only time you work there. So
wow, and so that in itself,
Siberian winter.
That in itself must have had some crazy preparations that you had to do to be able to,
yes,
to get ready for the Siberian winter. I mean, was it comparable? You've been to probably two of the coldest places, Siberia in the winter and Antarctica. Comparable?
Yes and no. Actually, no, because Antarctica gets much, much colder.
Much colder.
South Pole, yeah. So South Pole is unimaginably cold. In summer, with wind chill, it was minus 40. So, and that's summer. Siberia was not that bad, even in winter.
In the winter.
Yeah, yeah. But remember, I was in southern Siberia. So if you were to head to northern Siberia, that's probably going to be really bad. Probably comparable to the South Pole.
Which one did you do first? Which one did you travel
to? I went to Lake Baikal first. And talking about preparation, I was actually not really well prepared because at the very last minute, I realized I hadn't bought proper shoes to go. And the very morning before my flight, I just picked up my leather shoes and came to the lake. And of course, the experiment is being done on a frozen lake and they're walking all over the lake on this ice. And the German scientist who was my host, he looks at me and says, "You've come to Lake Baikal in the winter in European summer shoes." And he was both laughing his head off and I think upset at me.
Yeah. Probably shaking his head going, yeah, what is happening here? Yeah,
so that was a big lesson not to, to be serious about these places.
Yeah. What other places have you been the cold places, the deep places, where else have you been?
The very hot places. I went to see a place in South Africa, deep inside South Africa, which is just south of, mm-hmm, the Kalahari Desert. And that's a gigantic piece of land called the Karoo, which makes up about 40% of South Africa's landmass. But it's empty. It's empty completely. And it's one of two places in the world that have been selected as possible sites for something called the Square Kilometer Array. That's going to be the largest radio telescope ever built. So they haven't chosen between South Africa and Australia yet. So it could either be in the Australian outback or in this very arid part of South Africa.
And again, it has to be someplace that is fairly quiet.
Yes, extremely quiet. Quiet in this case, pertaining specifically to radio waves. So telephone, mobile phone transmissions, television transmissions, even communications from aircraft down to ground control, those kind of things can be really bad for radio telescopes. So they have to find something that's accessible, mm-hmm, because you have to get there, but also completely silent or as silent as you can get.
How long did it take you to get? You flew into South Africa, went to Cape Town, and then how long did that trip take
Cape
you?
From Cape Town, it was an 8-hour drive into the desert. We drove from Cape Town to a place called Sutherland, where there's a massive optical telescope, stayed there overnight. And then from there, one of the South African scientists picked me up and then drove me further deep into the Karoo. I was completely in his hands by then. I didn't know where we were going.
You just have to trust.
I was completely trusting him. It was a long, long ride. And there is, you see someone once every couple of hours. There's nothing there. It's just empty. And there are farmers, but you don't see their farms. And they're gigantic farms, and each sort of, they require something like a few acres of land just for one sheep.
Right.
It's that barren. So
you need a lot of land.
A lot of
so
land
that
for
there's,
grazing.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's, I'm just looking at these pictures of the.
Oh, there you go. Yes.
Of the Karoo.
So that's the Karoo. That's actually, if South Africa gets to build the Square Kilometer Array, the center of the telescope will be exactly at that location. That's someone's farm that they've bought and decided that that's going to be the heart of the telescope.
But they've bought the land even not knowing whether or not they're going to be placing the actual telescope array there.
They're building their own telescope anyway. So they're building a gigantic radio telescope, which are going to be precursors to the bigger one. If they don't get the contract to build it in South Africa, then they will at least have their telescope. But if the bigger contract comes through, then the smaller one will just get subsumed by the bigger one.
And this this large, do you know the square kilometer array, what specifically is that going to be decoding? It's radio waves, but specifically what are they looking for with making it that much bigger?
So the idea is, at least for the book, I was interested in the implications of this telescope for cosmology. How do you study faint galaxies? Now, as it turns out, galaxies formed from hydrogen, and hydrogen can emit a radio signal, very faint, and these radio telescopes can pick up the radio waves from hydrogen in the universe.
Wow!
So if you're looking for galaxies using optical telescopes, you're trying to look for the light from these galaxies, but they get fainter and fainter, and it's very hard to find galaxies using optical telescopes as you go further back in time.
Right.
But you can, if you have a large enough radio telescope, pick up the radio signals from the hydrogen gas that should still be there as part of the galaxy. So a lot of the gas that led to the formation of the original galaxy would still be around and going around and around in the galaxy, and they should be able to pick up the radio waves from these hydrogen atoms.
And they're not, and the way that light becomes, I guess, dimmer as you go further back, that doesn't happen the same way with hydrogen?
But the thing is that you can build much bigger radio telescopes than you can build
optical telescopes.
So in that sense, even though the signals are faint, your instruments can be much more sensitive. So you can't imagine building a square kilometer optical telescope. And the square kilometer here refers to the surface area of the telescope, which is made up of 3,000 dishes, so antennas. If you add up the surface area of all the 3,000 antennas, you get a square kilometer. That's almost impossible to do with optical telescopes.
Right. Just looking at some more of these images. You did go to CERN.
I did, yes.
You went to CERN. Yeah. Now, the LHC, I mean, how long ago did you visit?
I went there when it was still being constructed, so I could actually go inside and wander around the tunnels and the caverns. And so they were very nice. They showed me around quite a bit.
And it's huge.
It is huge. It's a 27-kilometer long tunnel, circular tunnel. And then at four points along this tunnel, there are massive caverns where the actual experiments are being built or have been built.
Right.
So these caverns are literally 300 feet underground, and they're so massive. You can go into one of the caverns that you can see the picture there, and that's just the shaft looking into the cavern from the top. The shaft itself is about 200 feet long, and then inside below that is the cavern where the experiment is being built, and that's the ATLAS experiment. So this experiment is one of the experiments that's going to look for new particles.
Mm-hmm.
So these proton beams that we were talking about, the 7 tera electron volts, those proton beams are going clockwise and counterclockwise along the tunnel, and they collide at four points of the tunnel. And at each of these points, they have to build an experiment to analyze the debris of this collision.
Yeah,
and that's where this one of these experiments is.
I like to think of it kind of as a like a car crash. Like if you have two race cars going around a racetrack and then they crash head into each other.
Yeah.
So if you had, you know, toy cars, little electric cars that you could spin around a little mini racetrack, and then the springs and the bolts and the tire goes bouncing off in one direction, and you have the debris, just like you're talking about. And then you can find, you can look for those little pieces.
Yeah.
What are the little tiny pieces that make up the debris, and is there anything in there that we don't know?
And that's the big question. The one difference between that analogy of two cars crashing and this debris coming off in the form of springs, we're still talking of them as constituents of those cars.
Right.
Now, what happens with protons is when these high-energy protons collide, they just completely become a ball of energy. Mm-hmm. It's pure energy, and from that energy, you get these other particles that that just pop out, and then they decay into the particles that we know of, like electrons and photons and things like that. And by analyzing what comes out from that ball of energy, mm-hmm. you can start understanding what the universe might have been like when the energies were so high, just moments after the Big Bang. So that's their goal, to kind of reach a stage
those
when
energies.
You can sort of start analyzing what the universe might have been a few fractions of a second after the Big Bang and things like that.
Yeah. What do you think it's like at the LHC now that they've the experiments have started?
So you can't go in anymore because they will not let you anywhere near because
the whole ring is cold.
The ring is at 1.9 Kelvin, which is literally the coldest ring in the universe. there'll also be radiation that you don't want to be near the functioning detector and the experiment. So they won't let you. You can only be behind very thick concrete walls and things like that. So all these control rooms are protected.
They're all very well protected. So there's probably a different the culture of the LHC is probably changing as a result of the change from being constructed under construction to actually going into experimentation.
I would imagine so. I think the people building them, these are the kind of people who have spent 15, 20 years working on one experiment that is just about starting up, and it's going to take at least a few more years before they start seeing results. So I'm sure the expectation now of getting results is there, and they must be much more optimistic than they would have been a few years ago. Yeah.
Is there any place that you haven't been yet in terms of experiments that are going on that you've found out about since, you know, going on these initial trips for this particular book? Is there any place else that you're learning of that you want to go to that would be, you know, this experiment, I want to see it happening?
Yes, there's a neutrino telescope. There are a few neutrino telescopes being built in the Mediterranean Sea. So they're essentially just like the Lake Baikal neutrino telescope. They're building neutrino telescopes that are using the Mediterranean Sea itself as a detector. So they're putting these telescopes...
Which would be a wonderful vacation destination.
Yes. Exactly. So that would be beautiful to go to and see what they're doing. It's much more... It's very sophisticated. These are very big telescopes that they're building. And unlike in Lake Baikal, where they use the ice as a platform and have their ice camp on top of the ice, in the Mediterranean, you know, the sea doesn't freeze.
Right.
So they need... really very sophisticated ships and submersibles, and so it's a completely different scale of operation.
Which they can probably get from the oil industry.
Why? So if they probably, I don't know where they're getting it from. But
if you want ships that can handle that kind of a stable platform where you can do work that you can, you know,
probably
access
I
stuff.
I should check that out. Yeah,
I imagine.
But that's one place. And there are a few giant telescopes that are beginning to be built, the next generation of telescopes, also in Chile, but different parts of Chile compared to where I went, which I would love to go back to and see them.
Well, we're getting towards the end of our hour, but do you have any other books on the way? Are you focusing on New Scientist magazine? Are you, you know, maintaining your interest in learning about physics and writing about physics, or are you spreading out?
In terms of writing for New Scientist, I've always sort of spread out. I've tried to write about physics, but also about neuroscience and climate change.
I've been reading your work for years, I'm excited.
Well, thank you. I definitely am keeping in touch with the physics experiments that the ones I visited. I want to keep up and keep readers up to date with a blog. So I've been just keeping an eye out for results that might be coming out. And it's just nice to keep in touch with these scientists and the people I met.
And if anybody is interested in taking a look at the Edge of Physics blog, the Edge of Physics, here are some of the, it's at theedgeofphysics.com/blog. Fairly straightforward there. And you can find the book, and you can also find some of these stories, the updates on some of these experiments that Anil was just mentioning. I think it just seems like this was a fabulous, fascinating exploration and a project to get into. I mean, do you feel any, you said that there were possibly tears at leaving the South Pole, but do you feel like you're ready to embark on a new adventure, or are you, you feel sadness that, you know, the book
is out,
you know, this, it's done, the closing chapter of this part of your life?
I think I'm still learning to let go of this book. It hasn't, I'm not yet ready to go on to the next project. This still means a lot to me. So I think it'll take me a few months before I can wean myself away from this project.
Yeah, it seems like all this stuff the stories that you've told, this would make, as somebody mentioned it in the chat room just a little while ago, that this would make an amazing TV series, that this was, you know, a Nova special, or, you know, to follow, you know, follow the adventurer to the different places and to the corners of the earth.
Yeah, but TV works very differently. So there have been people who've said they were interested, but they work on very different timescales. So I don't know what's happening there. But you're right. I think it would be a wonderful special.
It would be, yeah. It would just be amazing. Because it's one thing to read something, but to see it yourself, you know, you have an image in your mind's eye when you read a book, and you create a world for yourself from the words that an author writes down, and then to actually see it, you know, to get that much closer to actually experiencing it yourself. Is that something that you enjoy about writing, and writing about science?
Yes, very much so. I think you know, in terms of this particular set of experiments that I went to and saw, I really wanted to communicate the wonder of science to the readers, and I couldn't think of a better way than to actually talk about this extreme stuff and somehow use that to convey just how amazing science can be and is.
Yeah. Absolutely. Do you have any closing comments, a take-home story for our listeners, take-home message, other than buy your book?
Buy my book. probably the thing that I closed my book with, which is that I very strongly felt by the end of the journeys that I think we have to protect these remote regions from pollution, and obviously from climate change and things like that, because if we lose these pristine environments, I think we're going to be left with no place where we can go to do these kind of experiments. And we'll essentially become, you know, I was thinking of the analogy with the monks. You know, imagine if the monks could never find silence and solitude, they wouldn't be able to then look deep into their own selves to ask the questions that they do. And in a sense, this is analogous to that, where if we end up with a planet that is noisy and that there's no place where we can go for silence for the experiments, we will not be able to look further back in time or deeper into space and understand our own origins. And to me, that would be a big tragedy. So in a sense, after traveling all over, I think that was the sort of deepest conclusion that I could come to, that we really need to save these places and make sure that they're protected.
And this is Anil Ananthaswamy from New Scientist magazine. He's written The Edge of Physics, A Journey to Earth's Extremes to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. You can find it at theedgeofphysics.com. And like I mentioned in the previous show, you can find it at audible.com. It is available as an audiobook. So while you're adventuring, you can listen to Anil's adventures in physics. I'd like to take this moment to thank you very much for joining me on the show. It was just fabulous to talk with you about all this. It sounds, I want to keep talking. This is great. So many adventures.
Thank you, Kiki. It was my pleasure to be on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for driving to Petaluma.
As I said, it was a wonderful drive.
And I'd like to thank everyone for watching. This has been Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki. And again, if you'd like any more information on this, you can find the book at theedgeofphysics.com. On next week's show, we're going to be talking not about the culture of Amazonian tribes or the extremes of journeying to find physics. We're going to be talking about whales. That's right. We're talking about whales. And until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter @Dr. Kiki or on my Facebook fan page, which I don't know the web address for. It's a little bit too long for me to remember. And you can subscribe to Dr. Kiki Science Hour on iTunes, or you can find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki. And if you need more sciencey goodness, you can find it at thisweekinscience.com, which can be found at twis.org, and which will soon be found, I'm going to announce it now, starting Monday, April 13th, 8 p.m. every Monday here on the TWIT Network. This Week in Science will be broadcasting live weekly from This Week in Tech. And you can check out the This Week in Science Book Club at twisbookclub.ning.com. And we're reading Collider, so extreme physics. Once again, we're reading Collider by Paul Halpern this month of April. I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning in to my Science Hour. And remember, all I ask you for is just 1 hour a week. Well, maybe two sometimes, but 1 hour a week. And all it takes is 1 hour a week to make your world a lot more interesting.